From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Are career criminals born or made? In the first half hour, we talk with the director of Iowa State University's Criminal Justice Program, Matt DeLisi. DeLisi says it's a sequence of events and layering of risk factors over a lifetime that mold someone into a lifelong repeat offender. DeLisi is co-editor of a new book on criminal theory that offers experts' insights from all over the country. Then psychologist Craig Anderson, also of ISU, shares a new study that he co-authored. It shows that as the Earth's average temperature rises, so too does heat in the form of violent tendencies. That's all coming up this hour after this check of the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In our second half hour, new research showing how global climate change impacts human aggression and violence. But first, a new study suggests that career criminals aren't necessarily born that way, and they don't just turn to a life of crime overnight. Joining us to tell us more is Matt DeLisi. DeLisi is an associate professor of sociology and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Iowa State University. In the new book, Criminological Theory, which he co-edited and contributed to, DeLisi helps detail the path to becoming a career criminal. Matt DeLisi joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Professor.
Good afternoon.
So if career criminals aren't born and they aren't made overnight, in a nutshell, can you describe how should we think about a person who develops a life of crime?
Well, they're born and made, a combination of both processes. And before getting into that, I want to sort of lay out a general understanding about the criminal population. There's really two large archetypal groups that you're talking about or considering. The largest group is what we would call normative offenders. And these are folks who develop fairly normally during childhood and during the adolescent years will engage in generally low levels of antisocial behavior, generally benign, almost trivial forms of adolescent angst and folly, so to speak. But as soon as they develop these antisocial behaviors, and a lot of them come from trying to navigate being a child and becoming an adult, so a lot of the delinquency or the deviance is related to alcohol use and drug use. Almost as soon as they emerge, they then relatively soon disappear. As people age and become adults, go on to college, join the workforce, complete high school, they realize that there's a lot to lose by engaging in antisocial behavior and perhaps more to lose by facing the criminal justice system. And so for most folks who will engage in antisocial behavior over their life course, it's going to be very circumscribed and short-lived during adolescence. The second group is really the group that we're thinking about in terms of theory and research and prevention. And this is a group that demonstrates antisocial behavior effectively across the life course. If we were to look at them in later adulthood, we'd find that they would be in and out of the criminal justice system, recurrently in and out of jail and prison, recurrently in and out of probation and other sanctions, and they would rack up many, many arrests. But if we were to trail backward through their life and go through their adolescence, we would see the very similar kinds of adolescent behaviors, but they would be at a much higher level, and they would be much more severe forms of behavior. But if we were to go back even further into their childhood, we would see very early in life, in elementary school, in fact, that there'd be troubling forms of behavior that seem to set them apart from their peers.
Mm. Can you give some examples of this behavior that would pop up even as early as kindergarten or elementary school?
Conceptually, the behaviors are all the same, but we really change the labels of them across the life course. So if you're looking at childhood, we would be talking about things called externalizing behaviors or behaviors where there's sort of an acting out. And likely you would be looking at certain traits that in and of themselves aren't necessarily problematic. But when they are at very high levels and they come together, multiple antisocial traits, that's where you have problems. Mm-hmm. So one would be impulsivity. Impulsivity in and of itself isn't a criminogenic trait, so to speak. But if you have children who are so impulsive that they can't focus, you're going to start to see problems in terms of their social behavior and particularly their school behavior. Others include temper or aggression. Others include the ability to recognize that there is a group or society, so they're generally narcissistic. These are some of the traits that, again, in and of themselves aren't problematic, but when you start to have all of these personality characteristics within the same person, coupled with other social risk factors, that's when you can clearly see children who are having difficulties controlling their conduct.
I was surprised to see in your book that there are biological factors as well, even prenatal factors linked with antisocial behavior. Talk about those a little bit.
Sure. In the past decade, it has historically been in criminology. It was mostly sociologists, and then there was also psychological approaches. But it was mostly sociological approaches focusing very narrowly on adolescents. And in the last decade, in my own research and my peers' research, but also just generally in criminology, there's been greater recognition that other fields have a lot to say about antisocial behavior and prosocial behavior. And so what we tried to do with the text is bring together experts who study crime really across the life course. And there's a lot to be learned from human development occurring prenatally and perinatally. And so what those chapters contain is information on how human development in the first few years of life, how the brain develops, how the personality develops, and how social environments mold or modify these factors can sort of set into motion a trajectory that's on a more prosocial path or on a more antisocial path.
Mm-hmm. So to what degree are individuals predisposed to antisocial behavior at birth? Is there such a thing that we might discover sort of an antisocial gene, criminal gene out there?
There's all kinds of genes. That's a good question. There's a number of genes. There was about 26,000 genes, first of all. So to suggest that a gene is associated with antisocial behavior is fine. In my own research, we find this. But you just have to consider that its incremental predictive power is very small. And so in most studies, you might have 5 to 10 genes of 26,000. So our understanding of the genetic underpinnings of antisocial behavior, and to be sure they are there, is very, very much in its infancy. But there are certainly genes that are involved in neurotransmission. And for example, neurotransmitters such as dopamine and serotonin, which themselves form the basis for higher order personality or temperamental constructs. And so that's really where you see the effect of genes, is what are the effects of genetic variants, which are called polymorphisms, on these middle grounds, which in the genetics literature are called endophenotypes. And those endophenotypes would be things like the antisocial traits that I discussed earlier. And in turn, how do those traits or characteristics lend themselves to behaviors? So it's really a building block sort of format where biologists and geneticists are at the early stages, and then it builds on up into psychology and sociology.
If you just joined us, we're talking today to the director of Iowa State University's Criminal Justice Program, Matt DeLisi, and we're looking at what goes into a life of crime. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you were on the path of criminality at one point. What does your experience say about the research you're hearing about today? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Now, most teens spend a lot of time in front of screens these days, as we all know, viewing or interacting in violent scenes. Concerns about the effects of, media violence are nothing new. But what do we know now about media violence in this age of extremely violent, extremely graphic interactive games and their link to actual real-world criminality?
Well, I have the expert here, so in some ways I could defer to Craig, but I'll sort of give you an example of how this layered approach would work. Video games are very common, and violent video games are certainly, you could view them as almost an environmental pathogen. And so if you took kids who, across the distribution, ranging from this more pathological antisocial group to the, quote, normal children, the effect of the video game or the exposure to the video game might have different effects across that population. Certain children might have protective factors in place where, even though they're exposed to these video games, they might have be relatively buffered from their effects. Whereas if you have a child who is already antisocial to a certain extent and perhaps lacks the social support from parents or peers to rein in their playing of the video games, and by reining in I mean normative play maybe of an hour a day versus pathological play of 10 hours a day, then you could see how these environmental effects could produce different kinds of behavior, even though all of the children, so to speak, are playing them.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, too, you're talking about adolescence. Early adulthood is really a key period these few years that people have the individual, him or herself, has a chance to diverge onto a path of antisocial behavior with those predispositions or not. So that's where we should be directing most of our attention?
Certainly identifying these criminogenic traits for what they are is important. And so if you think about adolescence, the end of adolescence, age 18, all of the traits that lend themselves to success, say the ability to delay gratification, let's just start with that one. Mm-hmm. It's essential that you can delay gratification to go to college. It's essential that you can delay gratification to enter the workforce, knowing that after working for a number of years, you will hopefully ascend or be socially mobile and improve your life chances. But if your ability to delay gratification is so delayed or you just simply can't do it, then things with long-term outcomes such as completing school, completing college, maintaining employment are very difficult for you. And so the earlier on we can identify ability to delay gratification along with other antisocial traits or traits that might be in the antisocial range, then the earlier we can provide prevention and treatment efforts to try and help children who might be going towards that antisocial path and veer them toward a more pro-social one.
Mm-hmm. How does this play out in terms of male versus female when we look at the development of a career criminal? Differences?
Huge differences. If you were to look at the most the way to think about it is the more extreme or as the extremity of the antisocial behavior or the violence increases, your sample will become almost entirely male. And so what I mean by that, if you were to look at, for example, the death row population in the United States, somewhere between 3,500 and 3,800 folks, there were probably fewer than 50 females. If you were to look at other samples, say, for example, multiple homicide offending or other forms of sexual homicide offending. Again, those samples or those populations would be almost entirely male. But it's not just for the more extreme forms of criminal behavior in adulthood. If you go back into adolescence, the sex ratio male to female for the more severe forms of delinquency is usually pretty high. If you go back even further into childhood, the differences in even antisocial traits such as impulsivity or effort for control is usually very high. There'll be much more a higher sex ratio male to female than mm-hmm. You might expect otherwise. And that then begs the question, why would that be the case? And that's why with the text we wanted to bring in biologists and sociologists.
Very good. We'll hopefully get to that question when we come back. We have with us the director of Iowa State University's Criminal Justice Program, Matt DeLisi. If you have a question or an experience to share, 1-866-780-9100. What goes into a life of crime? We'll address it further when we come back. 1-866-780-9100. Back with The Exchange, talking about what goes into a life of crime this first half hour with sociologist and director of ISU's Criminal Justice Program, Matt DeLisi. And before we go to calls, I want to have Professor DeLisi answer the question that you posed right before the break. We talked about the huge difference in terms of males and females, antisocial behavior. What would be the evolutionary explanation or the explanation for having this very big difference?
Well, evolutionarily speaking, males would be needed for more aggressive, proactive hunting kinds of behaviors. And we do have a chapter in the text from some of the leading evolutionary psychologists. So if we're to look back sort of phylogenetically, that's one example or explanation why there'd be such a clear sex difference in antisocial conduct. But the other one is really, in recent years, we've tried to break this nature or nurture dichotomy and recognize that it's truly nature and nurture that produces both pro-social and antisocial outcomes. And so males and females develop very differently in terms of their socialization processes, but there's also core differences in terms of some of their traits they have, even brain structure, that will lend itself to certain types of differences in their behavior.
Okay, let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Plenty of callers. John in Davenport to start us off. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I want to ask how your research relates to Francis Galton's theory of eugenics and the predisposition to various forms of abnormal or destructive social behavior and the events that led from that to sterilization of the mentally ill and eventually Hitler's use of American sterilization programs for the sterilization of the mentally ill in Europe.
Okay, a pretty big thing to address in a brief comment, but please, Professor DeLisi.
Well, it's sort of two responses. One would be, we've known for decades, for example, that there's this gigantic sex difference in terms of antisocial conduct. We've known that males are much higher risk for engaging in a number of forms of conduct, but that doesn't mean that that's going to immediately translate into policies that are going to socially control males compared to females, so to speak. So this idea that scientific information is going to then immediately translate into social policy and what the caller seems to be suggesting, repressive social policy, simply hasn't occurred. The other way I would respond to the question would be the earlier that we can identify risk factors or traits or characteristics that lend themselves to serious forms of antisocial behavior, then the earlier we can intervene to prevent them and treat them. So I guess it depends on your perspective. You can look at early risk factors as things that social policy might try and control, or you could look at them as risk factors that policymakers will try to address and help.
Mm-hmm. How does the research that you have all compiled in this book from many, many experts line up with our current approach, for instance, here in Iowa, to intervening and deterring people from a life of crime? Where is the science and where is the public policy here?
Well, the science is pretty good and the public policy is pretty good in that there's recognition that there are risk factors across domains of life that lend themselves to antisocial behavior. And there are a lot of programs in Iowa and nationwide and worldwide that try and reduce them. One of the problems that we have found is that oftentimes we intervene too late. The longer you wait for people to develop, the more difficult it is to change these habituated forms of acting and thinking. And so if research can more clearly show earlier on in life, these are the traits we want to focus on. These are the deficits we want to focus on. Then we can hopefully have greater crime prevention and therefore less of a need for criminal justice.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. David is joining us from Des Moines. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted a quick question for the doctor. What does he think about the desensitizing of our youth and some of our younger adults through the input of video games and more graphic scenes on videos? And I'll wait for my call, wait for my answer on the radio. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, David, from Des Moines. You addressed this a little bit beforehand, but what difference does it make to a young person whether their exposure to violence comes in the form of a computer game or actual violence, verbal or physical abuse in the home, for instance?
Well, these forms of violence, these environmental pathogens certainly do not help. And so the greater exposure that a young person has to not only violent video games or violent media generally, but also just a generally unloving and uncaring environment, whether it's from their family, whether it's from their siblings, whether it's from their peers. So you see this in the bullying literature. The more negativity that that child is exposed to, the more likely you're going to be increasing those environmental risks that, coupled with the neuropsychological risk they might have, is going to likely cause problems. Something I could have mentioned earlier, one of the central findings from this more biosocial approach is that we often see that genetic risk factors and neuropsychological risk factors interact with environmental factors to produce antisocial behavior. And generally what you find is that children who have the biological or neuropsychological risks, when those are coupled with environmental risks, which you could just call a general coarsening of the culture or general exposure to violence, those are the very children who are most likely to have the most severe outcomes. Mm. And so the good news, so to speak, would be that if you have a more pro-social and healthy environment, that can mute or dampen down the biological or neuropsychological risks that the child might have, and the result would not be antisocial behavior but pro-social behavior.
A lot of factors going in here, and you have the neurological, the social, the environmental factors here. If you could have an individual represented on a pie chart, how would you divide it up into things that are under our control and other things that are these neurological things that you might have at birth?
Well, behavioral geneticists do very complex statistical techniques, but they essentially boil down traits or characteristics into three parts. One is what they call hereditary factors or genes, and the environment they split into two sections. One would be shared environmental factors, which are basically family background, and the other they call non-shared environmental factors, and these would be unique environmental factors that a child seeks out, such as their peer group. In terms of antisocial behavior, about half of the variance, about 50%, is accounted for by genes. That means that the other half is accounted for by environment. And so sort of to amplify what I said earlier, if you can manipulate in terms of public policy or treatment or intervention the environment, you can mute the genetic risk. And let's say you take children who have no genetic or neuropsychological risk, but nevertheless they're exposed to very antisocial environments, they too are going to be likely to engage in antisocial behavior, even though they lack the biological risk factors.
Mm. David is in Waterloo. We have just a minute or two before we take a break. Quickly, David, what's your question or comment?
I'm just wondering about those people that go through life living a criminal or relatively active criminal life that don't get caught, or for some other factor, you know, whether sheer luck or some other factor. Is there any reliable estimate on what those people represent? Like, again, using the example of a pie chart.
In terms of responding to that, if you looked at people who were generally antisocial but not necessarily criminal, then they could go through life without arrests or criminal justice involvement. And these would be people who were highly impulsive, highly narcissistic, were socially parasitic, but not necessarily criminals per se. But the notion that there are these master criminals, so to speak, who go an entire life without getting arrested is largely a myth. Even if you look at very severe homicide offenders who are arrested sort of for their culminating activity, you're going to look back and see some forms of antisocial behavior that resulted in arrest or even a jail or prison sentence. And you're also generally going to see severe antisocial behavior in relationships, in school, and work, that even if it didn't rise to the level of an arrest, was nevertheless a risk factor or troubling.
Okay. We're going to take a short break now, and we're going to come back. Matt DeLisi will stay with us, director of ISU's criminal justice program. And when we come back, if global warming is a scientific fact, then you'd better be prepared for the Earth to become a more violent place. Psychologist Craig Anderson will join us. He is director of Iowa State University's Center for the Study of Violence. He'll share a new study that shows a connection between global warming and violent tendencies. That's when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange over the noon hour from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa is second only to Texas in terms of installed wind power capacity. This week, two wind energy conferences are taking place in the state. That's why tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about issues crucial to the continued development of the industry, the challenges of getting Iowa-generated wind energy to areas of the country with the highest demand. Tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're talking about crime and violence with Matt DeLisi. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University, Director of the University's Criminal Justice Program. Well, if global warming is a scientific fact, then you better be prepared for the Earth to become a more violent place as well. That's because ISU research shows that as the Earth's average temperature rises, so too does human heat in the form of violent tendencies. Joining Professor Matt DeLisi is psychologist Craig Anderson. He's a distinguished professor of psychology and director of ISU's Center for the Study of Violence. Both of my guests in Iowa Public Radio studios in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Professor Anderson.
Good afternoon.
Now, the two of you collaborated on this new research presented last month at the Sydney Symposium of Social Psychology in Australia, showing how global climate change impacts human aggression and violence. Describe what you found.
Well, basically, we've come up with three different ways that any kind of general increase in temperature, in global warming, is likely to increase violence, again, on sort of a global scale. The first way is one that actually has a lot of research behind it and we've known about for some time. The first one is a fairly direct effect on individuals, a direct effect of heat. When people are uncomfortably warm, uncomfortably hot, we know that increases the likelihood of aggressive behavior and actually increases violent crime rates. That one has been well researched for a number of years, and we've kind of updated some of that research in our more recent work. But that's not terribly surprising to us that the newer data on that particular route sort of leads to the same conclusion. The other two are ones that are more are newer, have less what I would think of as psychological research behind them, but there is a fair amount of historical research behind them. One has to do with what happens when large populations are subjected to fairly rapid climate change or an environmental disaster, especially populations that are kind of living at a subsistence level anyway. Well, those populations basically have to move. You get food shortages, water shortages, basically a lot of resource shortages. And just for survival purposes, they have to start doing something different. In many cases, that means migrating to another location. But typically, you know, they're going to be migrating. In fact, we have a new label for it that some of the other people working in this area have come up with. They call it eco-migration, where you're migrating for ecological reasons. But that brings them into conflict with other groups because, you know, basically the other groups are also competing for those resources. So what you're likely to see, and there's some research evidence supporting this, is an increase in what you might think of as instability within a country, which in more extreme cases can, in fact, lead to civil wars. And you might also see some increases in conflicts between countries. And again, there are historical examples of where this has happened going back in historical records in China for, you know, centuries and centuries ago. There are also examples, more recent examples, you know, within the last, you know, 100 years or so of similar kinds of things happening.
And I think in one of the cases you point to right here in the United States, you point to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina as an example, correct?
That's exactly right. There's some research on what happened both within New Orleans, but also what happened when large groups of people essentially migrated to other parts of the country, in particular Houston. Took in an awful lot of people. And, you know, one of the explanations for the increase in violent crime that occurred in Houston was that you got all these criminals moving in. And it turns out that that's actually not true. That is, there were a lot of background checks done on people who moved to Houston from New Orleans. And there really wasn't a disproportionate number of people with criminal backgrounds. But basically, whenever you have a lot of social instability and economic instability, one of the things that happens is you tend to get an increase in crime and an increase in violent crime. And then the third way that global warming or actually any kind of rapid climate change is likely to increase violence some years down the road actually fits in very nicely with a lot of Dr. DeLisi's work. And that has to do with what kinds of things in the environment influence very young children to essentially grow up to be sort of what we might think of as violence-prone individuals. And as it turns out, that a lot of the risk factors for growing up to become a violence-prone individual are things that are, in fact, going to be more common whenever there's a rapid climate change. So things like poverty and resource shortages of one kind or another, broken families. One of the things that frequently happens is that the males in a population will tend to move out, like, you know, the fathers will go farther and farther and farther afield to try to figure out, you know, ways of essentially making a living. And that leads to more broken families. So, again, there are just a host of what you might think of as life stressors that are going to become more common. That is, a greater percentage of children worldwide are going to be exposed to more of these life stressors as a result of rapid climate change.
Talking about crime and violence this hour with Professors Craig Anderson and Matt DeLisi of Iowa State University. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Ames, where Vic is standing by. Hi, Vic. Vic, are you there?
Yes, speaking.
Yes, go ahead, please. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, well, I'm really happy for this topic because I have been working in this area somewhat for many years. And I was really happy to hear you touch on the issue of poverty and crime because I've seen that firsthand. I'm aware of one study that showed that a minority male in an inner city has a better than 90% chance of being involved in the justice system growing up. And that's pretty high predictive power. And I know in our county jails, a vast majority of the people there have poverty as one of their main risk factors. And I'm also aware of some special education classes with children that have behavior problems. In one case, the class that my wife taught had 10 out of 11 children had poverty as one of the biggest risk factors in their behavior. So I think these are issues that there are some things that we perhaps could do more to change by offering more opportunities and letting children see that there was a chance for them to make it as they grow up.
Okay, Vic, thank you very much for that comment, 1-866-780-9100. As we address these issues, professors, violence, crime, how are we doing in Iowa in terms of public policy in addressing, in intervening? I asked this earlier in the hour. I want to see if you have some further thoughts on that.
The economic turndown and ensuing cuts to a variety of programs really makes the problem in Iowa and in many states much worse. One of the newer kinds of research is coming out is just how absolutely important good nutrition is, both prenatally as well as in the early childhood years. And it turns out that poor nutrition, which of course goes along with poverty, both prenatally and in early childhood, dramatically increases the likelihood of an individual later growing up to become a more violence-prone individual, particularly if they have certain certain kinds of genetic background that really puts them at risk. So, you know, given that you know we've had increases in poverty and you know more children not getting good prenatal, postnatal, just food and nutrition, That's one of the big issues. Another issue is, you know, the dramatic cutback over the last, say, 5 years or so of social support in terms of our, you know, social workers and ability to intervene in homes that are at a behavior level are less than ideal for children, and you know, really does put more children at risk for growing up to become more aggressive and violent and sort of antisocial in general. So while, you know, there is a safety net in the United States in general, and while Iowa has a, you know, a safety net in place that's certainly much better than in many parts of the world, we could do a lot better and, in essence, save ourselves a lot of money in the long run by spending more money now on a lot of these early childhood nutrition as well as sort of good parenting kinds of programs.
Professor Anderson, going back to the link that your research made between global warming, climate change, and increased violence, considering that crime is a hot political topic and so is global warming, do politics ever interfere with your good science there? Do you have some reaction that is of a non-scientific nature to what you're saying here?
Yes. In the more recent case of where our research on global warming and violence, we have gotten some hate mail, and it would be amusing because of the poor quality of the thinking reflected behind most of it, except that, you know, it's clear that these people are serious, and that's kind of unfortunate. As you may recall from some interviews we did a long time ago, you know, my main area of research for many years has been on violent media effects,
right.
and we certainly get a lot of hate mail and a lot of bizarre accusations on the internet, things that just, you know, are absolutely untrue. And I know that I was speaking with Dr. DeLisi earlier, and he's now gotten some hate mail on because of this global warming paper that we've been working on.
Okay, let's go to Dick in Dubuque. Dick dialed 1-866-780-9100. Good afternoon, Dick. Welcome to our program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm curious on Joseph Campbell and Robert Bly. They seem to have taken more of the poetic or myth type approach to the problem with violence or juvenile violence. That is that boys need more of a rites of passage, where girls go through a rite of passage by their changes in their body. So I wonder if from studying other cultures, primitive cultures, and other things, it seems like guys need to go through a rite of passage.
Okay, good point. I think where Dick's going there is, you know, we always say boys will be boys, and they have these troublesome times, often in their teens. How do we separate that, this impulsive teen, narcissistic, of course, also time, from tendencies that will be antisocial?
Well, one of the things that certainly is lacking in many households in the United States is a strong, positive sort of male role model, that, and this goes along with, you know, not just not having, say, a father or father figure or strong role models in the community, but strong positive role models in the kind of media that we consume as well. As Dr. DeLisi was mentioning earlier, I mean, people learn a lot of their social behaviors by watching what other people do. That can be real people in the immediate neighborhood, or that can be, you know, the electronic media. And the models that many males get in the U.S. these days, the dominant models are really not that positive in many ways. And you know, we could do some things about that if we, for example, dealt with some poverty issues. If we dealt with, you know, if we provided a more positive media environment for boys, there are a lot of things that we can do that we, you know would improve things. But as a society, for the most part, we've chosen not to do, mainly, I suspect, because it costs some money and it costs some effort.
When we look outside of the United States at violence and career criminals, how do America's antisocial people, career criminals, compare with those of other countries? Isn't that be a good way to look at the societal effects? Is it the same the world ever over? Do you find this population in these numbers, these percentages, the world over?
This is Matt talking again.
Yeah, Matt.
It's a great question. The research is amazingly consistent. The original work was done in the United States in Philadelphia about 40 years ago, and they found that about 6 to 10% of a sample or a birth cohort accounts for more than half of the delinquency and crime. And when you look at the more severe forms of behavior like murder and armed robbery and rape, they account for 70 to 80% of the crime. That 6 to 10% core career criminal group has been replicated countless times in samples and birth cohorts from North and South America, Europe, Australia, Asia, and you consistently find almost identical males, so to speak, all of the same antisocial traits, even though there are complete differences in many circumstances in terms of their cultural background. And so that empirical finding to me suggested that it's not just social or environmental factors, which would miss really sort of the classical sociological view would have you believe, but it's probably a combination of nature and nurture. And so that regularity of that finding is pretty robust.
Right. This is Craig. One other thing I guess I might want to mention on this is that, you know, most people around the world think of the United States as being kind of the violence capital, at least in terms of modern industrialized societies. But as it turns out, that yes, we're number one in terms of homicide. But when you look at other kinds of violent crime, we're not number one. In fact, there are more assaults in, per 100,000 population, for example, in a number of European countries than in the United States. And one explanation that has been offered for this sort of discrepancy is that the reason our homicide rates are so high, even though we don't actually commit more assaults than other countries, is because we have such easy access to guns. And that if you sort of take into account the fact that it's much easier to kill someone with a gun than by any other means, that's you know, we're just better at homicide,
right?
Because we have, in some sense, better tools.
So when people run amok, if they have an Uzi compared to a club, it makes it quite a bit of a difference.
Right. It makes a lot of difference both in terms of the effectiveness of the tool, but also in terms of the psychological. It's much harder to be, you know, sort of stare at someone's face and stab them with a knife psychologically than it is to stand several feet away and shoot them with a shotgun or a handgun.
Professors DeLisi and Anderson, I'd like to spend the two remaining minutes to look into the future, to ask you, where is this research leading us? What are we likely to know about the criminal mind, or what would you like to know about violence in the criminal mind that we don't know today?
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in is sort of this emerging area of research where we're looking at kind of the combined effects of what we might think of as social risk factors, like, you know, media violence, like poor nutrition, like certain kinds of parenting methods. How do these interact with certain kinds of genetic structures, particularly genes that have, you know, that we know have something to do with the development of brain chemistry, whether it be dopamine or serotonin and other sort of neurotransmitters. I think there's a lot to be learned there about finding out who the vulnerable populations are and how we might better spend our sort of social capital on treating some of these issues when kids are pretty young.
Professor DeLisi, your concluding thoughts on this?
I agree that the gene by environment interactions are the, really the present and the future of criminology. And I think what criminology is moving toward is what psychiatry did decades ago, and that is identifying within the brain or the neurological or neural substrates that underlie traits and behaviors and perhaps even developing medications to treat them. So I agree with Craig. It's going to be just a flurry of gene bioenvironment work, and we're only beginning to understand it now.
So one day we'll be able to take a baby, perhaps still in the womb, scan the baby or test it some other way and find out if these predispositions are there, and then be able to be aware of them, first of all, and act against them in a variety of ways.
I don't think it would be that direct, because the constellation of traits that underlie criminality are, as we've discussed, themselves normal traits. And so if you take all of those traits and you have an individual who scores very highly on many of them, then that's really the person who's at risk for antisocial behavior. But it's not that the traits in and of themselves are problematic.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Craig Anderson and Professor Matt DeLisi of Iowa State University. Very interesting research. Thank you for coming to the studio and sharing it.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. Technical support also from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Look for The Exchange off to the left on that homepage. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.